You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
I'm Kathy with a K.
And I'm Kathy with a C.
And this is Killer Destinations. Today's destination is New Haven, Connecticut. New Haven was incorporated as a city in 1784, and Roger Sherman, who was one of the signers of the Constitution, became the city's first mayor. New Haven was the first planned city in the United States to be built on a grid system and was nicknamed the Elm City as a result of a tree planting program that was started within just a few years of becoming a city. New Haven is perhaps best known as being the home to Yale University for nearly three centuries.
That is incredible.
It really is. The city struck fortune in the late 18th century with the inventions and industrial activity of Eli Whitney, a Yale graduate who remained in New Haven, and I believe we all know it, fourth grade history, that he invented the cotton gin. A lesser known fact about Eli Whitney is that he also established a gun manufacturing factory in the northern part of the city near the town line of Hamden. The area to this day is still known as Whitneyville, and the main road through both towns is known as Whitney Avenue. Fun fact, Kathy, Eli Whitney's nephew invented the corkscrew.
Oh, now there you go.
Exactly.
That's a very useful item.
Cotton gin and a corkscrew. In addition to Eli Whitney, Yale University students and graduates are responsible for the invention of many items that still impact American culture. In 1776, Yale student David Bushnell invented the first American submarine. In 1828, Yale graduate Noah Webster, who we should all recognize that name, fulfilled his dream of writing the first American dictionary in an effort to standardize the American language. And of course, we can't forget about the inventions of the hamburger, lollipops, and the frisbee, all of which took place in New Haven.
Did it take a Yale graduate to see how many licks it got to the center of a Tootsie Pop?
In fact, it did. 375.
That's somebody with too big a tongue. That's not enough.
Yeah, I'm just kidding.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
Today, more than 3 million people visit downtown New Haven each year. And it's not just because of the pizza that is apparently known the world over. Have you ever heard of New Haven pizza?
I have not.
Okay. We have to go there.
Sounds good.
I don't know if they're going to let us after this. With its boutique shops, award-winning restaurants, scenic parks, and world-renowned museums, New Haven has become a destination city. But in 2009, it was not the accomplishments of university students or its thriving food and cultural scene that drew everyone's attention to New Haven. It was the disappearance of a Yale doctoral candidate who seemed to vanish into thin air. And before we start, we need to thank Jacqueline for giving us a story. She is also the one who told us about Kate Johnson,
right,
who was a student at the University of Portland about 4 or 5 weeks back.
Mm-hmm. And she's an excellent baker.
Yes, she is.
Thank you for the cookies.
Yes. Like many colleges located in large cities, Yale University in New Haven had a problem with crime on campus and its surrounding neighborhoods. Now, this isn't a new problem for any university, but in response to student-related incidents like thefts and violence and things like that, Yale actually established its own police department. But they did this back in 1894. And when they did it, it was the first college in the United States to do so. Today, the university actually owns almost 50% of the land in downtown New Haven. So crime prevention and responsiveness to the needs of students, residents, people who work there, people who are visiting, really remains a major cause of concern for the Yale student body, both undergraduate and graduate students. In February of 2009, in the monthly Bee magazine, which is the Yale School of Medicine's magazine, on the front cover was an article entitled Crime and Safety in New Haven. Now, the article began with a description of Yale as an intellectual hub with its own police force that, as we said, works in partnership with the city. But despite measures that were taken, such as door-to-door campus escorts and shuttle services, the Yale community was still plagued with thefts, some of which involved frightening confrontations. And you know what's funny is, I went to a private university in downtown Los Angeles, and they had the same type of thing. It was shuttle services and escorts and blue light phones within, I swear, like 15 feet. Mm-hmm. I never once felt threatened.
Oh, that's good.
Ever. But I also wonder how stupid I was.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. Not in general. I know. But yeah. Because I wasn't aware of it. And I'm Safety Marie, and you know that.
Yeah. But in college, everyone has a greater, what's the word I'm looking for, threshold for risk taking anyway.
That's true. That's a good point. So this article also compared the Yale medical campus to the medical campuses of other Ivy League universities in major cities. And Yale came up lacking. According to the stats, the Yale Medical School experienced more thefts per student than any other Ivy League university in the metropolitan area. The article then, of course, went on to include tips about how to stay safe. They had a conversation with the Yale police chief at the time. And basically, it was just little things about helping yourself not become a victim. And then it concluded with, all cities have their perils, but with a little bit of street smarts, one can avoid becoming another statistic. So when Yale police received a call on Tuesday, September 8th, 2009, about a missing student, officers responded immediately. It was almost 11 p.m. and a woman named Natalie had called police because one of her roommates, she had three in total, but one of her roommates, a woman named Annie Lay, had never come home that day from class. Now, she worked on campus. She was in the doctoral program and a pharmacology major, so she had a late class, but she always came home. The other thing that worried Natalie is that Annie always called her during the day. They talked several times, and Annie hadn't called her once. So that's why she called the police, and good for her.
And then one of the things that I thought was interesting, Kath, I read about this, that you said Annie always called Natalie, but it was specifically like, hey, I'm walking home by myself, can you meet me? Or, you know, hey, are you available to pick me up? Like, it was that kind of thing. Annie was very...
safety conscious.
Very safety conscious, very aware, because how far was her place from...
It was about 2 miles.
And she was a walker.
So she would have to walk through the university itself, but there are still those downtown roads that she would have to walk through to get to where she lived.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why Natalie was so concerned that she called the police that night.
Right. And just hours after she should have arrived home.
Correct.
When Natalie called the police, she told them all about Annie's routine and how she was very safety conscious. But she also told police that Annie was engaged. Her fiance named Jonathan lived in New York, and she was getting married in 5 days.
So a little bit about Annie Lay. She was born to Vietnamese parents in San Jose, California. So that's in the northern part of California. But she was raised by an aunt and uncle. She had a full blood sibling, but her aunt and uncle had three kids, and her aunt and uncle were referred to as her guardian parents. And she viewed her cousins actually as more like siblings right. because they were raised together. And she grew up right near Placerville, California, not far from San Jose. And she grew up in a wooded, rustic area that honestly sounded somewhat idyllic and beautiful.
In a lot of things that we saw, Placerville was referred to as Placerville.
Placerville.
Now, Kathy and I like to pride ourselves on looking up the names of cities and how to pronounce them.
But it turns out pride goeth before the fall.
Exactly, because we got schooled last week in a nice way-ish.
We talked about Waukesha, Wisconsin instead of Waukesha.
It's Waukesha. So yeah. We decided we're not making fun of anybody who called it Placerville. Exactly. It is Placerville, but you know what? You get a pass this time.
We didn't want to upset anybody from Wisconsin, okay?
Yeah.
Which I just did because I think I did a Minnesota accent.
Yeah, but you also kind of see, you have a connection to Wisconsin, so you're allowed to.
I do. Actually, my mom loved Wisconsin, and that's where she, when she was little, you know, there's a million lakes, obviously, and that's where they would do their summer vacations from Chicago. But also, turns out I'm supposed to be a millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a great grandfather who was a contractor. And I love this story because he only had a 6th grade education, but he was a total genius and invented a lot of things. Unfortunately, he didn't patent them. However,
he was no Eli Whitney.
Exactly. So he went to visit Wisconsin, went to the Dells. And what did he do? I want to say Lake Dalton. Lake Dalton had collapsed because of a dam. I want to say the dam broke. It was a man-made lake. So he basically built a new dam and developed this entire area and made a beautiful hotel. And he started his development in, I think, 1925. By 1929, when it's all ready to go and he's invested $1 million essentially back in those days, the crash, the stock market crash happens and it completely went bust. And years later, other developers came in, bought him out.
Took advantage of that.
I mean, he basically went bankrupt. And in the article, there's an article about him on the Wisconsin Dells historical page, and it talks about him being worth $30 million.
In that era's money.
Exactly. And so that all just fizzled away in the stock market crash. And so I'm supposed to be a millionaire.
Well, and as Kathy knows, I'm supposed to be one too, but that's going to have to be a New York episode. So right. When we do that, we'll get into that.
Exactly.
How Our Family Failed Us is going to be the title of the episode.
But anyway, so sorry, Wisconsin people. We will do better at pronouncing your names.
Yes. Everybody now, we're looking it up.
Exactly. So back to Annie. She's growing up in this very wooded, beautiful area at the base of the Sierra Mountains. She is smart. She attended Union Mine High School in Placerville. She was number one in her class. I think there's a few hundred students in the school, valedictorian. And when it came time to apply for colleges, she got like $160,000 in scholarship offers. Like, the girl was super smart. She wound up going to the University of Rochester in New York. What did she major in? It was something smarty pants, like cell and developmental biology. She was engaged to a man named Jonathan. She met him while she was attending the University of Rochester. And I don't know, did he attend there as well?
He did.
Okay.
When they graduated, they split and went to different graduate schools.
So Annie was accepted to Yale University's School of Medicine's Biology and Biological Sciences program.
Correct.
Her goal was to get a doctorate in pharmacology, and she was set to get that, assuming everything went smoothly, in 2013.
Right.
She was very, very smart.
And apparently she had energy that could light an entire town.
Yeah, I guess one of the things that people talked about was she was stylish and she was really funny. She supposedly had an excellent sense of humor. And so you got to love that in a person.
Well, and in that article, the crime article, do you remember?
Oh my God, yes. She was kind of trashing Yale crime statistics compared to other Ivy Leagues. And she was like, oh, well, we can take solace in the fact that we have a higher income potential than the other universities. But anyway, so she was like making jokes about that.
Made a comment about when we look at the stats, and then made a comment of, we're not talking football stats here, because Yale, I don't know if they've ever fielded a strong football team. Right.
Exactly. So she and Jonathan had a long distance relationship, because at this point, Jonathan is at Columbia University. He's doing a graduate program, and he was also science related too. He's like Mr. Smart Guy. Anyway, so they're like 75 miles from each other. They get engaged and they decided to have a reasonably short engagement, about a year. And again, she was set to be married 5 days from the night that she was reported missing. So people wondered, did she get cold feet? Is this really a missing persons case, or did she simply walk away? However, the police were taking it seriously and the university was taking it seriously, and they offered a $10,000 reward to anyone who came forward with information that led to Annie's whereabouts.
So the police reached out to Annie's fiancé, Jonathan, and he told them that he had talked to her at 8 a.m. that morning, as they normally did, and that they were supposed to speak again at 7 p.m., but Annie never called him. And he said he didn't report it to anyone and wasn't really concerned because he assumed there was a reasonable explanation for the reason that she had missed their call. After talking to Jonathan, the police also checked in with local hospitals to see if maybe she'd been in an accident or something, but they weren't able to find her there either. So they resumed looking for Annie again early the next morning. They started out with her office. She actually had two offices. One of them was the Sterling Hall of Medicine, which is where she did a lot of the work, the writing of the reports and that kind of thing. And then she also had an office at the Yale Animal Research Center. So they spoke to people at the Sterling Hall of Medicine, and they said that Annie had left that office around 10 a.m. on Tuesday, September 8th. This was the same day that the police were called. So after talking to the folks at the Sterling Hall of Medicine, they walked a couple blocks over to the Yale Animal Research Center to go look in Annie's office there. The research center requires a little bit of explanation. One of the things, and of course it's in the title, it's an animal research center, so they did use animals to conduct experiments. As a result, security there was tight. you pretty much didn't move without a key card or a camera telling them where you were. It was mainly because there were a lot of people who were doing protests against animal testing and whatnot, and although they hadn't had any problems, they wanted to make sure that if they ever did, everybody and everything within that building were secure.
Kathy, it was funny because I read an article where it was written by somebody from Yale. I can't remember. Anyway, it was funny because they're like, although animal activism is a thing and this could be people protest, there's never been a violent protest at Yale.
Never.
There's always a peaceful protest at Yale. Like, it was just so funny how they're like, those other schools have violence. We don't have violence.
Exactly. We're Yale.
Yeah.
So when they got to the research center, they found out that all doors required a key card. Now, even if you had a card to get into the building, your key card only matched the areas where you personally were allowed to be in. So some were allowed to go down to the animal testing center, which was in the basement. Mm-hmm. Some were only allowed to go to a couple of different offices or conference rooms. And so police went to her second office thinking that was probably the best place to start. Annie had a laboratory in the basement. There were two primary labs in the basement. One was used by Bennett Labs, which was a company that Annie actually worked for. And then the other room that was down there was used by a different lab. So she had the laboratory down in the basement that she used a lot. And then she also had a standalone office that she also used. And that's where the police started. They walked into the office, probably hoping, I think, a little bit to find Annie having pulled an all-nighter, right, trying to get some research done, something like that. And sadly, they didn't find her there. But immediately they did find her purse, which contained her keys, her cell phone, her wallet, and her daily planner. They were shocked into silence because when they looked down, they saw that Annie's shoes were there. It meant that she did not leave that building of her own volition. That, Kathy, is when they called the FBI and the Connecticut State Police to help.
So as Kathy said, everyone who was able to get into the lab had to use a key card. So one of the first things the police did was look to see when Annie's key card was used. And she got into the lab on that morning, September 8th, Tuesday, at 10:11 a.m. But what they also noticed was that it was the last time her card was used at all. In interviewing the people who ran the lab, they found out that there was a fire alarm that went off in the building, and that was just a little bit before 2 p.m. And according to protocol, everybody was supposed to be ushered out of the lab. And so what happened was, it wasn't a false alarm.
Right.
There was a machine that cleaned the lab equipment.
It did.
And it started steaming, and so it set off the fire alarm. Anyway, the building emptied out and people were outside for about 30 minutes. So officers knew that Annie could have left during the fire alarm and simply not returned. They also find out that there's a bunch of interior and exterior cameras at this facility, as well as surrounding the building.
There were a ton. There were like 75, 80 cameras.
Exactly. There were a ton of cameras, at least 75.
Yeah.
And so now they know they have a real missing person case, not just somebody who had cold feet about a wedding. Exactly. Yeah. There were at least 100 officers dedicated to the case. They collected all the footage from the surrounding area and the interior and, you know, exterior of the building and just started going through it looking for Annie. However, they couldn't find her in any of the video frames. So during the course of the investigation, naturally, all the employees at the lab, and particularly the people who were there that day, were interviewed. Did Annie have any enemies? Are you aware of any personality clashes? You know, just like the typical investigative stuff. Well, one of the animal technicians said, oh, by the way, I've known Annie for 4 months. I'm so sorry this, you know, she's missing.
She was really, really nice.
Exactly. Talked about how nice she was. And everybody was saying the same thing, of course, like what a wonderful person she was. So one of the animal technicians that they interviewed said that he left the building at about 12:45, which would have been before the fire alarm went off.
Right.
And he said that he saw Annie leave 15 minutes before he did. So now police officers have to go back and look at the video again because they were really focusing on the fire alarm and they didn't see her leave. So they thought, okay, maybe she left before that. They start poring over all the same video again, but they're backing it up. They're being very thorough and they're trying to find when Annie left because they wanted to see what direction she took. They were hoping that that would provide them with clues as to her whereabouts.
And if she was with somebody.
Correct.
And I heard the second time that they were going through it, they went frame by frame. The same day they got the tip about Annie leaving before the fire alarm, they also got a tip from a different animal technician about something that had happened that day. This animal tech reported to the police that she had seen a box of essentially wet wipes on top of a steel push cart in one of the two lab rooms. Now, there were two down there. One of them was labeled G13. That was the lab where Annie worked. Down a little corridor, there was another lab there. That was the one the other laboratory used. That was G22. So those are the two. But where this lab tech saw this box that had blood spatter on it, she actually was in G13, the lab where Annie worked. She reported this to police, and so the officer who she spoke to immediately called the FBI and waited for them to come because they were heading up the evidence response team. The evidence team comes in. They confirm that it actually does look like blood spatter is on this box of wipes. They put it into evidence. Then they start really looking into everything. Now that they have something that confirms there might have been something that happened down in these rooms, they got to look at everything. So they start going through trash and recycling and whatnot. But in the recycling box, they actually came across an extra large lab coat, clearly not belonging to 4'11", 90-pound Annie. And it looks like it has reddish brown stains on it that also could have been blood. And the stains were on the collar and on both cuffs. The investigators also went to Annie's residence and collected items like her toothbrush and other things that they found in the trash that they presumed would have Annie's DNA on them. So now they have DNA that they can compare to any of the items that they have found in and around the lab. And they were able to match her DNA to the blood spatter found on the box of wipes. Although law enforcement was working hard to find Annie and as much evidence as they could, the next major breakthrough didn't actually come until Saturday, September 12th. This is 4 days after Annie was reported missing, the day before her wedding. And then, Kathy, this is so sad. By this time, Annie's parents and family members who had flown to New York for the wedding,
for a joyous occasion,
along with her fiance, they were all in New Haven praying, seeing if they could help, on pins and needles, not knowing where their loved one was.
Exactly.
And it turned out that on Friday, so the day before this big breakthrough came, they canceled the wedding. The investigators now on this Saturday, they were scouring the research building from top to bottom. They were actually even pulling out blueprints for the building to make sure there wasn't any like hidey hole that had been put in there
right,
or something that they or even other staff members who worked there wouldn't have known about. So it is on this Saturday that investigators located a crucial piece of evidence, and it was in a ceiling tile in the hallway between the two labs in the basement, G13 and G22. When they moved the ceiling tile to take a look, they found clothes, a rubber glove that had blood on it, and a low-cut white sock, you know, like a women's sock that you'd wear with tennis shoes.
Like a little booty sock.
Exactly. That looked like it had a blood stain on it. So now they know they're hot onto something happening in that basement, and they start scouring everywhere. The next place they went, Kathy, was the locker rooms. There were several lockers and a restroom attached to it down in the basement.
Lockers for the employees.
For the employees,
items,
yes.
Purses, jackets, whatever.
Exactly. When they went into the locker room, they actually found a locker that didn't have a name on it. In this locker, which was like a bottom locker, they found a pair of work boots that on the back of it had the name Ray C on the back of them, one of which was missing a shoelace. And these boots had blood spatter on them. They also found a navy blue scrub top that had what appeared to be blood on the front of it.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Now investigators know that at the very least, evidence was hidden in this lab. But they're also thinking something more nefarious happened because obviously there's spatter on the white box. So now they bring out luminol or something akin to luminol.
Right.
They start spraying it all over the labs, G13 and G22. In G13, they find that luminol lit up blood spatter on the wall that had clearly been wiped away. And in G22, there was also blood that had been wiped away. There was not spatter necessarily, but it was clear that somebody had cleaned both of these labs.
And one of them was a drain. Like one of the areas was a drain.
That was,
I believe,
G13. G13.
Right.
Exactly. That's right. They found blood on the walls in G13, blood near the drain.
That looked like it had been cleaned.
Correct. And then white marks in G22.
Okay.
This was Saturday, as Kath said, Saturday the 12th. So they come back on Sunday, again, searching for anything they can find. Upon entering the locker room area, they smell the smell that every police officer can identify. It is a decomposing body. So they bring in cadaver dogs. The cadaver dogs immediately run to this wall right next to the toilet, and there is an access panel. Detectives slide it back, and there is a decomposing body of Annie Lay. The access panel was meant to allow workers to access the plumbing in case repairs were needed. And it was a tiny space, only about 2 feet wide. And it was clear that the insulation had been moved. Annie had been placed in there and the access panel had been closed. So she was holed up in this wall for days.
Five days.
Yes, before they found her.
And they found her on the day of her wedding.
Exactly. The family is notified that a body has been found. The fiancé is notified that a body has been found, but police will not say it's Annie. They were extremely conservative and cautious, and they said, we are not going to say anything until we know for sure. An autopsy was done that day, and it was confirmed.
Yeah.
It was Annie Lay, and all of her relatives who had flown in for the wedding, all of her fiancé's relatives, her fiancé, of course, everybody was completely and totally devastated and in complete shock. And one of the things I read, Kath, was that I can't remember the location of where they were supposed to get married. They were going to get married in New York.
It was in a Syosset boat club?
Like some type of club, some type of, yes.
Yeah.
And so the club had anticipated guests or journalists perhaps showing up. So they hired bodyguards to basically be outside the club and politely say, please go away. There's no wedding here. And sure enough, the club was correct because a bunch of journalists showed up.
If for nothing else, they wanted the pictures.
Exactly. And, you
empty
know, asking
wedding.
Questions yep. and when was the wedding canceled and all that kind of stuff. But just totally devastating.
Yeah.
When the evidence team removed Annie's body, they found three things that were important. They found the booty sock, another booty sock that appeared to match the one that was found in the ceiling tile.
Right.
They found a green ink pen and they found jewelry beads as though like a bracelet or a necklace had broken because those same jewelry beads were found in G13 where detectives ultimately determined that the murder occurred. The green ink pen was important because lab techs and animal techs had to sign initials on certain pieces of paper depending on what they did during the day. So now they knew they could match this green ink possibly to the killer. So as we mentioned earlier, one of the lab technicians told police officers that he left before the fire alarm went off and that he saw Annie leave the building. Well, he was Raymond Clark. Remember, the boots had the name Ray C. And it turns out detectives knew that his key card had been used to enter Annie's lab, G13, at 10:40 that morning. Annie had gotten into the lab at 10:11, and we know that he arrived at 10:40. So it turns out detectives knew that, I want to say by Wednesday.
They did.
So on Wednesday, when he was volunteering this information about when he saw Annie leave and, you know, that kind of stuff, which sent the detectives back to looking at the video.
Erroneously.
Exactly. That day, because his key card was the first and last key card that was used in Annie's lab, they drew a bead on him and they said, hey, we'd like to take your DNA. And what they actually did was they got a warrant for it. They didn't mess around. They didn't just, you know,
ask him to offer it.
Get permission. Yeah. Exactly. They made sure it was a solid warrant. So they got a mouth swab, a hair sample, a blood sample. So they had Raymond Clark's DNA taken on Wednesday. And so now they have something to compare all of this blood to.
As Kathy said, they collected his DNA. And what they were hoping was that the DNA that they found on some of the different items, the things in the ceiling tile, the lab coat that was in the recycle bin and whatnot, they were really hoping that they could use this DNA from Raymond Clark and match it to DNA found on some of the items they collected as evidence. Sure enough, they were able to match it to the lab coat. This is the one that had blood on the collar and on the cuffs. They were able to match it to the sock they found in the ceiling. And this was the sock that also matched one that Annie was wearing when they found her.
Right.
And importantly, on the lab coat and on the sock, not only was Raymond's DNA found there, but Annie's DNA was on those items as well. The other thing that we mentioned is that they had found the green pen underneath Annie. And they were hoping they could match that green pen to something that Raymond had written during the day, forms he had signed, whatnot. And when they tested the outside of the pen, there wasn't any DNA at all from Raymond. But on the inside cap of the pen, they did find Raymond's DNA. They also found that in the morning, any of the forms that Raymond had to sign as a part of his normal workday, whether it was signing into something or signing off on something, he used a green pen. After about 12 o'clock noon, I think it was right around the fire drill time, he started using a black pen. Now, obviously, this isn't in and of itself enough to say, oh, you absolutely did it. But combined with all the other evidence, the police were certain that they found their killer.
And one of the things that was also important was that we talked about how Raymond had told police, he offered the information, oh, you know, I left before the fire drill and I saw Annie leaving 15 minutes before me. So, of course, that sent the police back to the video. Painstakingly combing through the video, frame by frame, she was not on there at all, which of course drew their suspicion.
Police had obtained Raymond's DNA because they were suspicious from the get-go, right? They were like, this guy had access to the rooms where Annie was, to the labs. He was the last one to use the key card to get into it. Really, there was just something sketchy about it, right?
Right. He gave us wrong information about the video, you know, that kind of thing.
And so on that Wednesday, so the day after Annie was reported missing, the Yale police, New Haven police, all the police agencies, they started, I don't know which one it was specifically, but they started surveilling him. And they were very covert at first.
Yeah, they started surveilling him on the night they took DNA from him.
Right. So this is like 36 hours after Annie disappeared or Annie was last seen. So he was under surveillance. They get the DNA. They run the DNA after they were able to link him to a couple of items. Mm-hmm. Don't know that he's the killer still, but, you know, kind of thinking it.
Pretty sure.
They became very overt in their surveillance of him.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure there's like a cop thing where they're like, we're going to let him know that we're following him. He might get nervous, blah, 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 blah. Well, what Raymond Clark did is he drove 25 miles on the night they took his DNA.
Right.
And he checked into a Motel 8, which isn't even good enough to be called a Motel 6.
Right. On the scale of it, it's like, yeah, it's worse. Yeah.
But anyway, so they know that he checks into this motel and they're surveilling him very overtly now.
Right.
They're like, bro, we got you.
They're
You're
like
it.
The pizza delivery man.
Exactly.
Comes to deliver it. And they're like, dude, I took a slice, but hey, we're outside. If you're not going to eat all of it,
don't mind
it with
us. Oh, and by the way, do you have a light? Do you have a light? Knock, knock, knock. Do you have a light? We're just waiting in our car.
Yeah, it's cold. Can we have a blanket?
Our coffee's cold. Yeah. Do you have any hot coffee in that room? So anyway, so they were doing overt surveillance.
Speculating a little bit, but it was close.
Yeah, exactly.
Super close.
Yeah, we do think that, you know, they were taking poetic license.
Yes, exactly. After the police were able to collect the DNA and match it to items that they had found in evidence, it was 9 days after Annie was first reported missing that they arrested Raymond John Clark III for her murder. Bail was set at $3 million.
Which he couldn't meet, so he was tossed in the pokey. And then once he was arrested, of course, everyone began speculating about
people who do that. Just
exactly like us.
No,
you know, about began speculating about why he would do such a thing.
Right.
And Kath, you and I talked about this. Most of the articles that I read, you know, when they were interviewing people from high school or whatever, right, were very positive.
Right. They couldn't see him in the man they said that they arrested because he was so nice and kind. And
totally.
He was like star athlete for baseball, quarterback of the football team, la, la, la.
Yeah, supposedly funny, good friend, like volunteered places, blah, 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 blah. You know, and then they started scratching the surface. And then, you know, up pops this old girlfriend from high school who's 16.
We're assuming he was 16 or 17 at the time.
I'm assuming he was around her age.
For his benefit, we're assuming that.
Exactly.
Which and why so, we're doing that, I don't know.
Right.
But we are.
So
we're givers.
This girl was interviewed by Diane Sawyer on ABC News. And she was saying how when she was in high school, she was dating Raymond. And she decided it was time to break up. And he was not pleased with that. So he began stalking her. He became physically violent to the point where she, as a high school student, finally tells her mom what's going on, and they go to the police. And her parents were escorting her to high school, I think, for like 2 weeks. But the police had a conversation with him, is my understanding.
Yeah.
During the course of her communication with police, she told them that he forced her to have sex with him, but she didn't want to press charges. In this interview with Diane Sawyer, she's trying to like get into this information and, you know, tell us what he was like in high school.
She
what did he did
scoop.
To you? She wants the scoop. And this girl who is sitting there with her mother says, I'm sorry, I can't talk about this. The police asked me not to.
Right.
So she's in this interview and is revealing literally nothing.
Which good for her.
Exactly. Good for her for sticking to it. And basically the message that she conveyed was that he was controlling and that he was unhappy that she was the one breaking up with him. And so the funny thing is, Diane Sawyer asked the mom, like, what did you think?
Right.
And she's like, I thought he was a nice boy.
Yeah.
You know, like everybody, it's like the things that other people had been saying about him.
It was exactly.
Apparently difficult for many people to reconcile that he was a killer.
And really, I mean, honestly, he was 24 years old at the time. So it's not
yeah,
like
they were both 24,
it's not like
he and Annie.
And it's been
correct.
All these decades since high school. Like, that, it isn't that much difference.
Yeah, no, that's true. And here's what is so, well, everything about this case is horrific, but Raymond had a fiance who actually worked in the same lab as he did.
As his brother, was it brother-in-law and sister worked there too?
Correct.
Also as animal technicians, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They worked there first and he saw how much they liked their job. They probably
and how
got
much money
paid
they made.
Well. Exactly.
Yeah.
So his fiance, his sister and his brother-in-law take a break from work. They're basically horrified. They cannot believe that, you know, whatever this happened.
And my theory is, speculation warning, that Yale didn't want them around because there's still all of the press there and you've got all these other people. They don't know what role they might have played in all this.
Yeah.
I mean, not that they did, but you just, you know, there's that suspicion and they probably wanted them to, you know, stay away.
Again, I don't know.
Speculation.
But one of the things that Yale did do in the articles that I was reading, they basically told the staff and students to zip it. You know, nobody is going to be talking trash about Yale. So actually, in the article that I read, one of Annie's roommates was being quoted. And she said, and it's quoted in the article, I'm not going to give you my name because the university told us not to talk. And so what actually disgusted me a little bit was when it was determined that, yes, this was Annie and this poor girl had been murdered in a lab. The president of the university at the time came out with a statement and he basically said, this could happen in any city, in any university, anywhere in America. This is not about Yale. It's not about the university setting. It's not about domestic violence. This is workplace violence. This is about workplace violence. And I just thought, oh, come on, buddy.
Yeah. If really he'd kept his trap shut, I would have respected him a lot more. But
for
trying
sure.
to deflect it made it look like it really
like
was
just,
their fault.
Just get out there,
right.
say how horrific
right.
it is.
And say how sorry you are for her family and how much she'll be missed. And zip
yeah,
it.
But instead he was saying this couldn't have been predicted.
Don't blame
he
us.
Was waiting for the lawsuit. This couldn't have been
yes,
predicted.
Exactly.
You know?
And there was a lawsuit.
Which the lawsuit did come by yes. Annie's mom, who settled for $3 million. But anyway, so
on St. Patrick's Day 2011, Raymond Clark entered a guilty plea to murder in the first degree and attempted sexual assault. But what's interesting was it was an Alford plea. Do you remember what this is?
I do.
I actually had to say what it was.
Kim Kardashian would be super
proud
of Kathy right yes. now and her Killer Destination School of Law experience. So why
yes.
don't you tell them what an Alford plea is?
An Alford plea means that the person who has been arrested and is before the judge, doesn't admit to actually doing the crimes that they were accused of. Instead, they say, okay, I'm not going to say I did it, but I know that they have enough evidence to prove that I did it. So I'm going to plead guilty with an Alford plea and really hope that the judge gives me leniency and doesn't sentence me to a WAP or something worse. Life without parole. That's my favorite. You all should know that.
Kathy loves her
LWAP. I want that like embroidered on something.
Exactly. Seriously.
We're going to have merch that just says LWAP on it. And no one will buy it but me.
Exactly. I love that idea. One of these days we will have merch. Yes. We're only 4 years into this.
Exactly. But we're full-time employees at other places to pay for it. So
Exactly.
So subscribe. So he does the Alford plea. The judge does not take leniency on him, really, because he gives him 44 years before he'll be eligible for parole. He will be eligible for parole in 2053. Now, we know, and we've told everyone this, LWAP or whatever you get doesn't mean that that's how much you're actually going to serve. The Menendez brothers, perfect example of it.
Right.
So as of now, he remains in prison.
He's still there.
So far, he's served 16 years of the 44-year sentence. If that changes, we absolutely will let you know.
I wanted to read something that I read about Annie's funeral that broke my heart, honestly. Annie's funeral took place on September 26, 2009 in El Dorado County, where she lived. The funeral took place at Holy Trinity Catholic Church. At the funeral, Annie's mother read a poem in Vietnamese, and it was translated into English by her brother Chris, and it included these lines. It said, "I sang lullabies by your side this week, like I did when you were a baby, wishing you a peaceful sleep. Farewell, my child, the most wonderful gift that God had sent to me." And she described her daughter's death as being like a searing knife through my soul. Just the idea of a parent. Yeah. Yes, a mother speaking at her daughter's funeral, because it's so unnatural.
Right.
To bury a child when children of any age predecease their parents. It's so unnatural. She wrote a poem specifically to be read at her daughter's funeral. So in October of 2009, the Yale School of Medicine held their own memorial at Yale's Battelle Chapel. Now, I don't believe that Annie's family went to the memorial. I'm not 100% sure, but I don't believe they went. However, they composed something to be read, you know, while she was being eulogized. And it said in part, "Annie was loved by everyone who knew her and special to all those who came in contact with her. She was a kind-hearted human being who was devoted to her family and friends, always sacrificing her time to help others. Her laughter was infectious and her goodness was genuine. She was a considerate daughter, a thoughtful sister, a generous niece, a spirited cousin, a loving granddaughter, and a gracious friend. We will always remember her beautiful smile, her fun-loving spirit, and the joy that she brought to us all. Annie Marie Lay will be profoundly missed."
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.